Read me romance. Read, read me romance. Read me romance. Read, read me romance.
You could take a look in a book, that's fine. Or you could sit back, relax, and unwind and
read me romance. Read, read me romance.
Hey, lady listeners.
Welcome. What's up, lady podcasters?
Are you trying to change it to lady podcasters?
I feel like you just...
Yeah, no. I feel like you're trying to shift
the focus. No, I'm talking to you.
Focus.
I feel like when you say, hey, lady listeners, you're talking to the people listening. But I'm greeting you guys because we just got on here. I'm like, what do you want me to say? Hey, bitches. I mean, like, what would you rather I say? Hello. Good afternoon, Tessa and Melissa.
Good afternoon. How are
you? Good afternoon.
Lady listeners, we're here for a really, I mean, I feel like it's a really special week because it's Sierra Simone week. And I think probably a lot of you maybe haven't listened to the podcast yet, and this is your first time because Sierra Simone is, she's like a powerhouse, but she's also really, like people who listen to audio specifically love Sierra Simone quite a bit because she has great narrators and people like to hear her words like in their ears, in their ear holes.
Well, you're coming in wrecked, it sounds like.
I'm coming in wrecked, yeah. I read, but wrecked in a great way. Like I read this book, American Squire, that we're going to play for you today. I read it last week and then I immediately went back and did a reread of Priest by Sierra Simone, which if you haven't read it, I think it's kind of what, you know, put her name in everybody's mouth. It's an incredible book and it is the dirtiest. Like, it's just the hottest book. My jaw was on the floor three times. Even just during rereads, I was like, oh my God, I forgot about this part. It's like, obviously it's about a priest, you know, this girl that comes to town and they become attracted to each other just via each other's voices through the confessional booth.
Yeah.
And then they see each other. It's like, ooh. Okay.
What was that mini series that they had on TV like back in the 80s?
The Thornbirds.
The Thornbirds. I always think about that. It can be based in modern day, but anytime you tell me there's a priest involved, I immediately think about
that. My mother watched that with me.
Oh my God.
I know.
Did she really?
I swear to you. My mother, who is, you know, like she banned MTV and Friends and Married with Children in our house. She let me sit and watch Thornbirds with her.
I wonder,
to this day, I can't believe it.
Maybe because it was based on a book or something, you know?
Yeah, she's like, this is literary.
Yeah, exactly.
It's literary sex.
Can you imagine watching the Thornbirds now with your, you know, because, I mean, if it came out and it was made for TV, it was seriously in the probably late 80s. So you were what, I mean, eight?
I wonder how it holds up. Like, I wonder.
Watch it with your daughter.
Just keep the cycle going.
I'm going to look it up because I want to see what year it was. Talk amongst yourselves.
I'm just curious, like, if we watched it today in this generation of HBO and Game of Thrones sex with just, you know, tits all over the place.
I can see that. Like, it would be, like, really mild.
If it would be shocking.
I don't know, though, because I've let my daughter watch 80s movies, and they're so much more, like, over the top than the movies I show her now. You know, like, I showed her The Goonies at the same age.
Oh, my God, I was just about to say The Goonies.
Right?
It's not PC at all. Like, it is so, the words they say and the way they say them, I'm like... You know, like, there's a way that Disney and Pixar and, like, you know, like, Disney Channel or whatever, they find a way to add humor for the adults in a way that it goes over the children's heads, but it makes it funny for you. Yeah. It makes it bearable for you to sit through a two-hour movie about a car or whatever. And, like, and it makes it, and it's entertaining for them. And, like, The Goonies is just straight up, it's for... 18 and over, I think, you know? Whereas I watched it as a 16-year-old, 15-year-old, and I thought it was fine.
Fuck you, I watched it, like, 8 years old.
And it's a great movie, obviously, but for a 7 and 8-year-old, it was like, I was like, oh, I think I'm probably going to put pause on this till she gets a little older.
So The Thornbirds was in 1983, so it must have done, like, a replay or something, but I remember being,
it definitely
like,
did.
Really young.
She... 83. Oh, she must have been rewatching it, because I remember I can tell you what that priest looked like, and I can think of his I can think of his arousal face.
It's Richard Chamberlain. Like, he was so sexy. Yeah. But I did see that there was a 2011 K-drama called The Thorn Bird, so they must have redone it. The K-drama must have.
Ooh. Like, what do you guys think of BTS? Just to be totally off topic.
I don't know. Is Jen Frederick going to listen to this? I feel like we might not be friends
anymore. Okay, so I didn't know anything about BTS whatsoever. Nothing. I knew they were a Korean pop band, and I knew there was like eight of them or something. And then I watched them on Saturday Night Live a couple weeks back, and I was like fucking impressed. They're really good.
Yeah, they're really cute.
They're really good. Yeah. Dude, I don't want to, like, I'm not attracted to them. Like, I feel like I would break them in half. They're like really young and just like.
They look young too. They're so young. I don't know how old they are, but they look like they're babies. Like,
they just look like they're 17. Yeah. But
I feel like they're younger.
Jen Frederick and her daughter have been like on tour with them. I think they hit the third concert last night.
They're so talented.
Just, like, following them around.
And they are adorable, like, in a way that I probably would if I was, you know, 14 or 15.
They're,
I would definitely crush on them.
Extremely hard to get tickets for. I remember Jen was trying to get tickets, and we were all in line to get tickets. Like, we had to keep refreshing our phone, and then you waited in a queue line, and we did this multiple times for multiple cities, and it was like a lottery to get picked.
They're massive, and they're actually doing a free concert in Central Park this week, and there's people camped out along the Central Park, like outside Central Park.
Yeah.
So the police are having to like clear out these like 16-year-old girls, like, you guys have to go home. It's like pouring rain. It hasn't stopped raining in like 4 days, and they've just been camped out there under tarps, like, to see these guys, which is.
Do you know what though? Like, it made me think when Jen was talking about, like, I said something about Harry Potter one time to her, and I was like, you know, I know this is like for kids, and she was like, I'm just gonna stop you right there. And she said, you know, something you love like that doesn't have an age limit on it. And she was like, and don't let anybody make you feel silly because you love something. And it really just stuck with me. And I feel like her fangirl over BTS is so pure and so good. And it makes her so happy. And then that's exactly how I feel about Harry Potter. You know, like you said, you know, like, well, if I was younger, I'd be into it and stuff. And I'm like, I think if you just like it, maybe you'd be, maybe it's just not your thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I think it's so cool. Like, when I saw a couple of people.
Oh, no, I like it. I just think crushing on them, I'd have to be younger. But I do like it. Like, when I watched it on Saturday Night Live, I was like, they are so good at what they're doing. Like, it's unbelievable. There's eight of them, and they're
crazy.
In perfect sync with each other. Mm-hmm. They're like, they must work so hard.
They're
you
showmanships,
know?
Too. Yeah. There's a lot of showmanship that goes on with it. And I thought it was, I didn't really get it until, again, like you did, I saw him live, I saw a concert, and I was like, oh, wow, that's cool. Because when I heard the music, I was just like, oh, you know, I don't really understand all the words they're saying. I kind of like the tune. It's cool. But then you see him perform, and it was like, oh, shit, they're actually really good.
They're really good. But, okay, so if you are, so this is the Read Me Romance podcast. If you came here for Sierra Simone, we are going to play the first installment of American Squire soon.
We're going to get to her.
We're going to get to her.
It's our first mail, right?
It's our first male on the podcast. Yes.
Ooh.
Right?
Yeah,
for sure.
I think so.
Yeah.
Well, you had your male, but that wasn't on the podcast.
It wasn't on the podcast.
We talked about heat stroke a ton.
Yeah, but and yeah. I'm actually really pleased by it. I feel like a lot of lady listeners didn't listen to male, you know, like prior to heat stroke, and I think I've maybe have converted them a little bit with heat strokes. So that's cool.
Absolutely.
And if you're already a listener, yeah, you're welcome. If you're already a listener of Sierra Simone, like you've already been down that path and embraced it and loved it. I reread. So I think this character Ryan Belvedere in American Squire, he's in the new Camelot series. There is a character in this book, American Squire, named Auden, who is in her new book, A Lesson in Thorns. Sierra Simone's new book, A Lesson in Thorns. His name's Auden. He's like the hot, mysterious owner of this like crumbling mansion. It's so beautiful in the English countryside.
I love that. Oh, I love that.
Her books are like, I don't know how to. they just yank you in. I could not put Priest down yesterday. And I said, I'd already read it. And I was just trying to like go through and read a couple of passages to get like refresh my memory. But now I'm just going to go and read every single book she's ever written, because she's just
read them right now on the air.
Oh, she's so good. If you haven't read Sierra Simone, you're like, there's a part of your life that you haven't discovered yet. Like, you just are on the brink of discovering it.
You're missing out.
She's so good.
She's in Kansas City.
She's in Kansas City.
Yeah, you said that last night. You were like, oh my God, I was doing her stuff and I just realized she's super close to you, right?
It said she's from Kansas City. I was like, oh, she's like right down the street.
That's so funny.
Yeah. Say hey. She's a former librarian, and I met her for the first time at Shameless Book Con. She came up to me
this past year?
Yeah. She told me she liked my books, and I was like, you can't just come over to me and just, I was like, you're going to give me a heart attack. I'm like, all of a sudden, Sierra Simone just comes over and starts talking to me. And she hasn't, I said, you have to like warm up with like an Instagram. Like, you have to like a couple of my posts first before you just walk up to me in person. You're going to like,
wow, that was bold. Heart.
I mean, like, no, in an amazing way. But I was like, you know, my heart can't take that.
That's that big dick attitude just coming on up to it.
So this, okay, so we're going to play American Squire, but like, I think that like our listeners especially would really like this book called Misadventures of a Curvy Girl, and there's an honest to goodness curvy girl on the cover, and I'm going to read you the blurb because you're going to go read it. Like, you're going to love this blurb. Okay, for the first time in her life, Ireland Mills is happy with her body. No more fad diets, no more hiding from every camera in the room, no more low self-esteem. She'd rather be alone than with someone who'll only love her if she's skinny. Caleb Carpenter and Ben Weaver are everything Ireland and Kansas Chamber are everything Ireland and the Kansas Chamber of Commerce dreamed of when conceptualizing the Real Kansas promotional campaign. They're handsome, young, educated, and totally dedicated to their small prairie town. When Ireland Prius gets stuck on a Kansas dirt road with a massive storm rips through town, she's left stranded with nowhere to turn but Caleb and Ben. These two hunky country boys are impossible to ignore, but could they ever be interested in her as well? Caleb and Ben are more than interested, and they're willing to share. After their first night together, they know this has to be more than a one-time thing. They need to make her theirs forever. But can they convince Ireland they love her? Curves and all?
Curves and all. I love it. What's the name of it again?
Misadventures of a Curvy Girl. And that's by Sierra Simone.
Is it standalone or is it a series? It sounds like a series.
No, so Misadventures is like it's kind of like, not a series, I would say, but it's like it is a series of books, but they're all standalone. They're all written by different authors. They're all called Misadventures of something, you know?
I've been stuck on a few country roads in Kansas, and I never met a duo of them.
Did you ever meet two hunky country boys?
No, I have not.
I love country boys. Why do I love country boys so much?
Because they're not around you all the time.
Because, maybe, no.
So, like, to you, listen, like, a CEO in a suit is attractive, where I'm like, those guys are assholes. I know them.
I don't know. I feel like I like country boys, but generally they're more proper. They're more gentlemanly.
No. There is a very fine line, and it is like within a hair between a nice country boy and a redneck. Like, it is so, like, it is so easy to flip that.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, you'll see one who's polite, says, yes, ma'am, da 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 da. And then they'll have, like, a Confederate flag flying out of the back of their truck. You know, like, it's like there is such a fine line between that.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, it's hard. Like, and I think that's why I don't like them, because it's like, you don't have to be a stereotype, but maybe you feel that way about your CEOs too. I don't know. What's attractive to me? I don't like European men, maybe, because they're not here, but maybe women over there think that's so played out. I mean, with the English.
I think sometimes with the country boy, people give it that, cause you know how you always see the bad boy romance. And some people, like, the word bad boy does not do it for me. If I even read it in a blurb, I'm like, I'm out. But I think it's the good guy. You think immediately a good person, generally. I like heroes that are good. Like, they weren't given a reason to be good. They're just a good person in general. They're not going around doing dick shit to be a dick.
You're a Captain America fan.
I'm a Captain America fan.
There you go. But I don't see anything wrong with a little arrogant asshole like Iron Man.
I like a little arrogance in a man. I do. I like a little arrogance in a guy. I feel like it's, you know, generally arrogance is considered a sin these days, but there's something about it that, like, I don't think confidence and arrogance is necessarily a bad thing in a person.
I like arrogance and I'm good at something arrogance. I don't like when a man knows he's hot.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no. Well, or he does. He does, but he's not like, I just read a book by Abby Jimenez called The Friend Zone, and that hero was the perfect, he like walked that perfect line of, I know I'm hot, but I'm also like not, I don't know, like I'm not just using it to get laid constantly. Like, I know I'm good looking, yeah. I'm a fireman, I take care of myself, but like, and I don't really have a problem getting women, but you know,
I always like when sometimes they hear the author or I'll write in that they're annoyed by it, that they're hot. Because the girls are always throwing
them. Oh, I do like that, actually.
And they're
I
like it when they're like,
God, like, I wish someone would like me for my brain. That's when you know it's a romance fantasy, when a guy says something like that.
When you're, well, the one where you're like, the book you wrote, Tessa, with the guy with the big butt, I just love that so much. Like, I don't know why, I just found that so endearing that he was like a little embarrassed by how big his butt was. I just like that.
That gives me such a lady boner when a man is like a little bit self-conscious about something in his body or even just like his massive balls or something.
Well, dude, that was like our book Thick, you know, where he was just, his size like made him ashamed because of how big he was. So stupid.
I die. Sometimes when I think about the stupidest stuff we've done and I slap and laugh, I'm like, remember that time we blah, blah, blah.
You guys,
well, had our book. Go ahead. Well, I was going to say our Wedding Cake Crusher book went to like number 3 this weekend and we were like, do you realize that we wrote a book about a girl who breaks into weddings for cake? And it went to number 3. I was like, I'm sorry, but that's fucking relatable, okay? That's why that one ranked so high. Fucking relatable.
I went and got a whole cake yesterday for myself.
I did too. You did. You made it sound so good.
Just to celebrate?
I swear. No, it's Mother's Day.
Yeah,
I went to Dairy Queen. I'm like, here's my whole cake.
Yeah, I bought my own. I did the same thing. I bought my own Mother's Day.
And she said, I sent her a picture of mine, and then she sends me a picture, and she's like, there's nothing wrong with this. I was like, yeah, there is. And I circled it. She got the mini one. I circled the word mini. I was like, you did it wrong.
It was a tiny cake, it wasn't a huge one.
Speaking of cake, did you guys see that dessert table video I posted? Yeah.
Oh my God. Tell me all the details. So you went to the child bride thing. What is this?
Oh God, we're really sticking it to the Catholics lately on this podcast.
Look, freedom of religion, but I can still be disturbed by this. Go for it.
No, I went to a first communion party on Saturday night. They had, it was an Italian restaurant in my neighborhood. And first of all, like when I walked in,
that was a restaurant.
It was a restaurant with a party room attached.
God, that looks so nice.
It was really nice.
This video is in the Read Me Romance Facebook group, if you're wondering.
No, yeah, it's on there if you want to see
it. I posted a video, of the dessert table at this party. And it was just like stacks of donuts, like literally stacks of dozens of donuts on like pegs, like wooden pegs.
Oh my God.
And cake pops.
Just piles of them.
And a golden cake and just all kinds of stuff.
Oh, the cake was gorgeous because it was like, I mean, I studied that for a little while. So it was 3 tiers. It looked like it was lightly frosted, but it had like where you pour the icing on the top and you let it drip down a little bit. So the cake was like a beautiful off-white champagne color and the icing was gold that went over the tops of it on the 3 tiers. I mean, it just looked so elegant and all the desserts were like color coordinated.
I walked into this restaurant and it felt like stepping into like Goodfellas, you know, like the movie Goodfellas. Like the host was just like, "How you doing?" And I was like, "What? What?" I live in Long Island and I lived in Brooklyn for a decade, so that's not unusual to me. But where I live now, like I walked in and it was just straight up like like a scene out of, yeah, like The Godfather. It was just super Italian, and I love it. I love anything authentic like that. And so I went into the party. I saw the dessert table. I took that video. But then the food started, and I have to tell you about the food.
Wait, how much dessert did you eat before we just skip that? Did you just do like one little plate? Were you modest about it?
I don't want to be a downer, but my daughter can't have dessert, so I don't eat dessert anymore. Because she's a diabetic. So actually, yeah, I did bring her. Well, actually, a really cool thing happened. My dad found a bakery that does sugar-free chocolate cake. So, wow. Yeah, so I did bring her a slice of sugar-free chocolate cake, really small one. I don't eat it anymore because she can't.
Yeah, I get it.
So anyways, the waiter comes around before, like while everybody's dancing, there's an airbrush table where they're like doing airbrush hats and t-shirts for the kids. There's a DJ.
I saw that. That was so fucking cool. Like, I want to do that at my next event.
It was
like,
really cool.
I want to have a party just so I could have an airbrush station where you can make those cheesy matching hats and shirts. That's fucking genius.
The kids were in love. They were having the time of their lives. And this girl, Christy,
so cool.
I've known each other since our kids were 5 months old. We had a music class together for like a children's music class. And I actually have a story. Like, one of my favorite stories about Christy is that we were both suffering from like postpartum depression, and I made her a mix CD to like help her get over it, like of my favorite songs. And then a week later, I was like, what did you think of that mix CD I made you? And she was like, I fucking hated it. Don't ever make me another mix CD again.
Why?
That's Christy.
What was on it?
Because like, I have the most obnoxious taste in music. I love like hipster. Like, I'm just like the hipster emo, just like, you know, people crying about their emotional state, you know, just like the most obnoxious music. I love it. And she hates it. She likes rap music. Like, she likes Biggie, and which everybody does, but she like loves it. She goes to like Jay-Z concerts and still. So anyways, the guy comes around and he takes our order. He asks us what we want for our pasta and what do we want for our main. So I'm already like, oh my God, they're going to bring us pasta and a main course. And I was like, holy shit, that's crazy. But then before that even starts, I have a list of what came out before for each table.
Stop it.
Fried calamari, garlic bread, potato croquettes, fried zucchini, antipasto, eggplant rollatini, and two pizzas per table before the pasta and the main course
the
even start.
Actual fuck! Is
I'm
that,
not exaggerating.
Those are appetizers. You're having pizza as an appetizer.
Yes,
I'm so wet right now. Oh my God! I can't handle this. Oh my God! This is what dreams are made of, Tessa.
I know. It was amazing. I sat there just in total awe, and my daughter was just like. And then, so everybody eats the appetizers and then gets up and goes back and dances for an hour. And then the pasta and the main course comes out. It was like the greatest party.
How great is that, though? I bet you left so stuffed and happy.
Yeah, I did.
What kind of pasta in the main course was it?
You had two choices. You could either do like a, I guess like a pancetta, like a red sauce with pancetta in it, or you could do the penne alla vodka. Oh. And then the main courses, it was like you could have salmon, you could have steak, you could have like chicken parmesan, whatever. It was great.
Oh, God.
We went out to eat a couple times when I was out of town, and I was sitting there, and my friend couple, they order like this huge combo app for themselves, right? Or for each other, they're going to share it as their meal. And I order one for myself and then another app. And then we keep going out to all these restaurants, and every time we'd go somewhere, somebody would be like, you know, this is a lot. And I'm like, if someone tells me one more fucking time that I've ordered a lot of food, or do I know how much is coming, I'm going to be fucking pissed.
Why? I feel like, who does that?
The waiter.
The waiter.
The waiter.
Every time the waiter would be like, that's a lot of food. I'm like, I know it's a lot of food. Can you just get my food?
Did you eat it all?
No, I like to eat a little bit of everything.
As a former waitress, I'm offended at how bad, like, a bad decision that is to say it to somebody because you're working for tips. Like, if you
order,
the more they order, the more 20% adds up.
Maybe it's just different, because I was in a different country that's different. I'm like, I know, I got it. I know what I'm ordering. Just bring it.
I've got this. Like, I always say, my best friends, when we go to brunch, they order pancakes for the table, and it's the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah.
They order everybody orders breakfast, and then they order an extra plate of pancakes for the table. Giant stack.
Yeah, because why wouldn't you want that?
Why wouldn't
you? That makes total sense.
Wait, so so how was your guys' Mother's Day? What happened? How was it?
Who wants to go first?
Mel, how was your Mother's Day?
It was fun. We didn't really do anything because I just got back from a trip the day before. We got home at like 7 o'clock at night. So Sunday, what I do, I just laid around and I ate my Dairy Queen cake and Domino's. Like, I text my mom like on Thursday. I was like, can we just order Domino's for Mother's Day? She's like, I'm down with this.
I love Domino's.
That's awesome.
So that's all we did was eat Domino's. We ate and laid around.
Yeah. That sounds like a great Mother's Day.
What'd you do, Leah?
What'd you do, Tessa? Oh, well, I'll go. We went to the beach this past weekend to my mother-in-law. Like, they were there. So we got to see them. My husband helped them, like, move some furniture and stuff. And I got to sit on the beach all day with my kids. So it was nice. Like, it was really chill on Saturday. Like, we just stayed on the beach all day while they played. And I sat under an umbrella and just watched them. It was really nice and relaxing. And Sunday, that was actually Mother's Day. It was like a pretty much a normal day. We drove home and it was like a 3-hour drive. But then we got back and I started laundry. I cooked dinner. My husband cut the grass. I went to the grocery store and bought my own flowers. And then I went because I love flowers. But I got some because they were already marking them down. So I was like, well, I'll get these. Yeah, I went to Dairy Queen and got an ice cream cake because Mel's looks so fucking good. So I went and got one. So that was it. Yeah, I mean, it really felt like any other day, honestly, because I was doing laundry and cooking dinner. I was like, well, this is Tuesday, so it is what it is. You know, I think, as the kids get a little older and you have more obligations, it's harder to, you know, make special time like that, even though you should make it more of a special time. But, you know, my kids are still small enough to where they're like, oh, cool, it's Mother's Day. Can you do this for me, please?
Yeah. Like,
they just don't have any.
You got your present. It's over.
Yeah.
Somebody tweeted, I think it was actually, not to keep bringing her up, Abby Jimenez tweeted that her kids were like, Mom, you shouldn't have to do laundry today. It's Mother's Day. Do it tomorrow.
No, right? Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, put your chores off until they pile up to enjoy this one day. And it's like, oh, God.
No, thanks.
What did you do? What did you do?
Well, I
saw you went out to dinner, right?
Brunch. Yeah. Oh, okay. I played the odds. It's rained every, so I coach my daughter's soccer team on Sundays, and they just decided they weren't going to cancel soccer on Mother's Day. So we all had to drag our asses out there in the field.
That.
I know. And so I was like, you know what? It's rained like every Sunday this season. I'm going to book brunch. And I'm going to play the odds. And if it rains, then we'll have a brunch reservation. If it doesn't rain, I'll just cancel it. But it did rain.
Yeah.
So,
Thank God.
I know. So we all went to brunch. My mom, my dad, me, Pat, Mackenzie, my brother. It was great. It was like bottomless mimosas. My mom and I like get along 60% of the time. And
I was just going to ask you how it went with your mom.
It was great. I only snapped at her once.
Oh, wow. Good for you.
It was great. The mimosas helped tremendously. And then I came home. I put on my robe. It was like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I stayed in my robe and a janky sports bra all day.
Oh, that sounds so nice.
Yeah, it was really nice.
I do that every day. I know Mel was gone last week and I had big plans to like write and be productive. And I was like, waited until the last possible minute to finish the words I had to finish because I was just like, you know, I just don't wanna. And I, you know, like, I hate that. Like, I wanted to be productive and I wanted to, like, you know, contribute and work. But then I was like, I mean, I could just shop online instead.
I think that's one of the great things about writing with somebody. When you're on at the same time, you're like, oh, I have to get this done.
Yeah.
But when the other person's not there, you're like, oh, I don't have to do anything really. I can put this off till tomorrow.
Exactly.
And then tomorrow.
Yeah, vacation till it's like 1 a.m. on Friday night and you're getting your words done.
I have a problem where I can't stop bringing up murder at family gatherings. Like, every time I get together with my family, I'm like, and like, even if someone just like slightly hints at something that is true crime related, I'm like, well, did you hear about this? And I'll just like scandalize the whole room.
Something super fucked up.
Yeah.
Did you do it on Mother's Day?
Uh-huh. Yeah. I was just like, I was just talking about hypochondriacs and like how if someone's telling you that, you know, this is probably going to be dark, but if somebody's just constantly telling you about the terrible things that happened to them, and every time you're like, oh my God, that's crazy. And it's every week, or they're lying to you. They're lying, right? And then I just got deep, darker and darker from there. I was like, do you know the definition of a psychopath? And I was just, and like the whole room is like, can we just enjoy Mother's Day? And I'm like, no, we're going to talk about this scary shit.
You're like, it's my day too, goddammit.
Did you watch the, I can't think of the name Ted of Bundy. It. The Zac yeah. Efron Ted Bundy. It was terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it terrible?
My husband and I got in this discussion yesterday about it on the way home because we watched it. But it,
explain to everybody what it is first.
So it's about Ted Bundy, and it's basically about his arrest and him getting away. It's just a trial, really. There's not a ton about...
He's played by Zac Efron. It's called Wickedly something.
It's vile, wickedly evil and vile or something.
Something like that.
It's what the judge said to him when he sentenced him. But anyways, so there's two things you can listen to on Netflix, and the other one you can watch where it's interviews, it's the interview tapes of Ted Bundy. It's actually him telling you about his victims, and I couldn't listen to that. And that was really disturbing, not because of the graphic material, but because he just enjoyed it so much. It, like, you could tell he was getting off on telling people about it. So I didn't like listening to that. But the Ted Bundy recreation that Zac Efron did, I saw an interview with Zac Efron and the lady that plays Elizabeth in it, who was, in real life, it was Ted Bundy's, like, girlfriend, who never experienced any of his, like, tendencies, I guess, or was not hurt by him at all. So she was just like, who the fuck is this guy? Like, for some reason, she just got the really nice side of him. But anyway, but I saw an interview where Elizabeth, or Zac Efron, says this movie is from Elizabeth's point of view. So she doesn't see the gore and the graphics, and she doesn't get all the details of the case. All you see is what she sees, which is the trial and kind of like their life together and then what takes place. So, you know, it's about her dealing with it. So I understand from an aspect of a true crime aficionado, I could see how this was disappointing. Because you don't get any of the details. I mean, they name the victims, but you don't really know what happened.
If you didn't know anything about Ted Bundy, you would watch it and go, oh, did he do it or did he not do it?
Yeah,
you don't find
absolutely.
Out till the end. And I'm like,
absolutely.
This
yeah.
is crazy. It's
and
just,
so,
you,
like,
yeah.
spoiler alert, he did it. But, like, you know, but I get that, you know, from that person, from a true crime standpoint, I think it was a big letdown. But if you just take it for face value and think, like, okay, this is Elizabeth's story, and it's from her perspective, and it's her doubt about whether he did this or not, and she was the one to turn him in. She was the one that saw the sketch, called police, and said, I think this is my ex. I think it's Ted Bundy. And so, like, that, I think, you know, if you get it from that side of it, I don't know. To me, there wasn't really a need to make that movie.
There was
though.
No need to make it. It was like he was just recreating, he was just recreating scenes. Like, it was obviously him and Liz and, like, their domestic life or whatever, and having, and that was all scripted. But then it was just, like, him recreating scenes that we've already seen a million times, like Ted Bundy, like, harassing the prosecutor, or, like, and, you know, I take really big issue in, like, with what the judge said to him when he was sentencing him, though, I have to say.
Really? Why?
He's like, you're a brilliant young man. You made these mistakes. He's like, I would have loved to have you practice law in front of me. It would have been an honor. I was like, are you kidding me? Yeah. I was like, this guy killed, like, 30 women. And he's complimenting him while he's sentencing him. Like, in a way that Ted Bundy was actually smiling. The Zac Efron, like, it's just a reenactment of it. But he actually did say those exact words. And I just, like, I was, like, throwing my remote at the television.
Maybe the judge was trying to give almost like an underhanded compliment. Like, this is what you chose to do, and now you're going to die for this when you could have done this with your life.
Yeah.
I just feel like he could use that opportunity to make him, to like really make him understand what he did, and to like, you know, this was the final moment. Yeah. He'll never understand. But
the best thing you can do to Ted Bundy is take something away from him that would have been great. Like, they're like, you could have been one of the best lawyers in the world, but you chose to do this, and now you're going
to
die.
But I think that's all he wanted was to be told that he could have been great.
Yeah,
he wanted to be told he's great, you know?
Maybe. I don't know. I just watched the whole thing, and I was like, I wondered if maybe they did this because they didn't know exactly how many people he had killed at this point. He was only convicted for the two because that's all they could prove. And I wondered if almost they stroked his ego a little bit, hoping that in time he would admit to more, because he's such an egotist, you know, like, and you know, and that's, I wondered that as well, if like, maybe it wasn't just like, okay, maybe I'll say this to get more from him later. I don't know.
Possibly.
But either way, it was, I feel like overall it was a disappointment. When John Malkovich was a fucking rock star, I wish there would have been more of that, but whatever.
John Malkovich, I saw him in person before. Did I tell you guys that?
Oh, maybe so.
They filmed Burn After Reading in my house.
That was it.
Yeah. It's a good scene too. Movie. I got to watch it be filmed. Okay, you guys, let's let them listen to Sierra Simone, American Squire. And after you guys have listened to the first installment of this book, American Squire, we'll tell you guys what deals and like where you can get more Sierra Simone. So hang out afterwards and we'll tell you all about those, you know, where you can get more.
All the good shit.
All the good stuff. Okay, let's send them into the first installment of American Squire by Sierra Simone. And we'll talk to you guys on the other side. Bye.
Bye.
American Squire. Few of us are lucky enough to know a real wizard. Even fewer of us are lucky enough to be sent on a quest by one. Or at least that's what I tell myself during my endless flight from DC to London, and during the following train ride to Exeter, and during the long, harrowing drive while I struggle not to scrape my rental car against the hedgerows while I consult the GPS on my phone. I squint at the screen and then sigh. Somehow it's taken me an entire hour just to make it 14 miles. I sigh again, as if hedges and sheep are Google's fault, and then toss the phone on the passenger seat. Supposedly, I'm only a short drive through a village away, but I didn't get much sleep on the plane, and everything is starting to feel blearily unreal. I've kind of given up hope that Thornchapel exists at all by this point. All this way for a book, I think tiredly. If the request for help hadn't come from Merlin and Nimue, Merlin's new, well, his new whatever she is, I might have said no. The president I'd served faithfully for 4 years is dead, and while his successor offered me the same job, I couldn't accept it. It feels too close to moving on, and I don't want to move on. Not yet. Not when I still feel so wrong inside, so ruined and lost. But when Nimue asked me to help her and Merlin, I felt a flicker of the old Belvedere. The Belvedere who could do anything and do it in trendy glasses and a smile. I said yes before I even realized I'd opened my mouth. I nudged the car over a bridge and into a village called Thorncombe that looks like it's been pulled straight off a postcard. It features a stone church with a square Norman tower, an accompanying graveyard with weathered tombstones, and plenty of pubs and adorably sagging buildings. It's only a few days before Christmas, and everything is hung with wreaths and ribbons and garlands, and it looks like one of those miniature Christmas villages my grandma likes to collect. I normally don't enjoy things this transparently festive, but it's strangely heartwarming to see the village all cozy and cheerful in the middle of the cold, brown wastes of the moors. There's no such coziness or cheer at Thornchapel itself. After a sharp turn and a trip over a small ice-snaggled river, I creep down the long driveway until I encounter a stern edifice that looks older than the hills themselves. Crenellations chew at the winter sky like stone teeth, and the windows reflect back trees and trees and trees. It's three stories of gray stone, asymmetrical and obviously added to over time. And there are no wreaths here, no Christmas tree beaming merrily through the front window. In a way, the lack of seasonal cheer is a relief, since there's a possibility I'll be staying here over the holiday. And I'd hate to feel like I'm imposing on the guest family, whom I'm told owns the estate. No, there's just a house and a book inside this house that's been promised to Merlin, and that is therefore my job to find. I park behind a narrow work van, taking note of the signs of renovation happening around the house. A big construction dumpster tucked discreetly around one side, a bucket of paint propping open the massive wooden door at the front, and then go to retrieve my suitcase from the trunk just as a sleek Audi pulls into the driveway behind me. I close the trunk lid and turn, wondering if this is the family lawyer, Mr. Kremer, who I've spoken briefly on the phone with. But when the car shuts off and its owner climbs out looking like a GQ cover, I know he can't be Mr. Kremer. I've worked in DC for 4 years, and every lawyer I know looks like he's on stimulants or blood pressure medication, or both. This man looks cold and fit and serene, a block of ice that's been carved into a god shape, clad in a bespoke suit, and then covered in one of those expensive wool coats. You know the kind, dark and long, and fitted just enough to make you want to slide your hands underneath it. Paired with a gray scarf, nice gloves, and burnished leather shoes, he exudes cool elegance and sophistication. He radiates the kind of remote power I can't help but crave like an addict. And his face. That face. I stop moving just to stare at it. Pale and striking, with high, graven cheekbones and a haughty mouth, he's got pearl gray eyes, dark hair with just a breath of silver at the temples, and an expression of pure imperial arrogance as he gazes at Thornchapel. He's Caesar standing at the Rubicon, Hannibal gazing at the Alps. It's an expression that says he's ready to conquer, and conquer ruthlessly. I imagine that look directed at me, and heat arrows down my spine. What would it be like to be the object of his merciless determination? What would it be like to have that leather-gloved hand gripping my jaw as he forces his cock down my throat? Hoping he can't see the heat in my face or the thickening behind my zipper, I give him a smile, and all I get is a slight nod in return. A couple of months ago, this would have barely registered. My job was to keep the President of the United States comfortable, informed, and on task. Hourly, I had to face down pissy senators, angry diplomats, and worst of all, the personal aides of other world leaders. It took a lot more than a cold nod to put a dent in my smile. But now, with Maxon Ash Colchester dead, and with me drifting from place to place with no direction and no purpose, well, this beautiful man's dismissal of me feels like another glum nudge from the universe, reminding me that nothing matters, and nothing ever will. My master is dead, and I'll never get to serve again. As promised by the dumpster and construction supplies, the inside of the house is a mess, which I can see even through my fogged-up glasses. Me and the wool-coated ice god are welcomed by the real Mr. Kremer, a tall, reedy man with rimless glasses, who shows us to our rooms and tells us that the owner of the house will be joining us for dinner. "I'm happy to take possession of the book at any time, Mr. Kremer," I say a bit hopefully, as he walks us both down to the ground floor to give us a tour. "I hate to be a burden." "Nonsense," Mr. Kremer says. "Mr. Guest is delighted to have you here. I'm certain he'll want to hear all your stories about working in the White House, and besides..." We're walking through a narrow corridor lined with arched windows to get to the library. It looks like something out of a monastery, as do the iron-bound doors set in the stone wall. And when Mr. Kremer pushes them open, even the ice god next to me lets out a startled breath. Before us is the library in Beauty and the Beast, if Beauty and the Beast were set in the austere gloom of the 17th century. There's countless books on sturdy, endless bookshelves, two stories of it all with plenty of ladders and clever little staircases to connect them. All the light comes from a large bank of two-story windows at the end, and the only ornamentation is the carved wood and the varied colors of the books themselves. The ceiling is so high and the room so deep that shadows curl like big cats in the corner even in daylight. "The library is rather big," Mr. Kremer states, in the bland tones of obvious understatement. "It might take you some time to find the book Merlin is looking for." The ice god has wandered inside the library, but he's not gazing at the shelves with the slack-jawed wonder I am. He's assessing everything with a cold, calculating gaze. Every now and again, he pulls a book off the shelf to examine its condition. His efficiency and dismissive contempt of unworthy items is powerfully erotic. I have no idea why. "Who is he?" I whisper ask the lawyer. "Ah, yes, that's Sidney Blunt," the lawyer replies. "From the auction house. He's here to catalogue the guest's artwork in anticipation of it being sold off." Sidney Blunt. It sounded like a war name to me. Or maybe something out of a 1930s pulp story about a soul-deadened detective who's forgotten how to feel anything but bitterness and lust. As opposed to Ryan Belvedere, which is a name that sounds happy and dutiful. At least it does to me. Or at least it did. "Mr. Blunt doesn't mind working this close to the holiday?" I ask, trying to push away from unhappy thoughts and move on to something else. Mr. Kremer gives the world's smallest one-shouldered shrug, so subtle I barely catch it. "Mr. Blunt's company stands to earn a substantial amount of money from this, and my client is eager to dispatch of the artwork. It was important to his father, and so Mr. Guest is compelled to remove it from the house." Even though Mr. Kremer's tone of voice hasn't changed, I can tell he disapproves. "I'm guessing his father is no longer alive?" "Correct." I think I can picture this Mr. Guest now. Thin and sour and old. The kind of middle-aged man who pins all his dead dreams on his father, while making all the same choices his father did. I'm already dreading having to make conversation with him, but I remind myself that I've dealt with worse in the White House. I can handle the mulish petulance of an old man for a few days. In the library, Sidney Blunt is now leaning over a curio case with his hands folded behind his back. Without the wool coat, I can see how perfectly tailored his suit is, how it clings to the lean lines of his torso and hips. He's tall and broad-shouldered, and even though I place him at about 10 years older than me in his late 30s, there's plenty of muscle testing the seams of his shoulders and arms whenever he pulls something closer to get a better look. "How do you know Merlin?" I ask Kremer. It's random. It's such a random thing to ask. But I feel like I've been staring at Sidney Blunt long enough for it to be weird, and I don't want the lawyer to notice. "We went to school together," Kremer answers. "We've kept in touch since then, and I help him look after some of his family's property here in the UK. When he reached out to me about that book, I was more than happy to talk to Mr. Guest about letting Merlin buy it from him. And as I expected, Mr. Guest said, and I quote, 'He can have the whole damn library if he wants.' I, of course, advised against that." Sidney strides back towards us, a haughty, well-dressed silhouette with the large windows behind him, framing him in pale winter light.
"Does Mr. Guest want the items in these cases appraised as well?" Sidney asks.
His voice is so sharp and precise that I could use it to fold shirts. I could use it to cut myself. I sigh, longingly, quietly. No one seems to notice.
"Just the paintings," Kremer replies.
"He should have all of this appraised," Sidney says,
turning back to face the room. This close, I could see the faint lines around his eyes and the barest shadow of stubble beginning to darken his jaw. I resist the urge to shiver again. My hunger for older men is insatiable.
Your client should bring someone in to see this library before it rots away in neglect.
I expect Mr. Kremer to protest, but he only gives a defeated exhale. Yes, I'll tell him. Sydney doesn't acknowledge this. He doesn't seem like the type of man to acknowledge when people have agreed with him, as if he expects that as his due. I also have a bit of a kink for that, too, if I'm honest. Kremer's phone rings, and excusing himself, he leaves to take it in the hallway, which means it's only me and Sydney left inside this moldering cathedral of books. I take a step forward, peering into the deep recesses made by the shelves, and consider my task. I'm very good at what I do, or at least, I was very good at what I did, before my employer and king died, and I didn't care about being good at anything anymore. Finding a book in a library should be no more difficult than getting a suit dry cleaned with only an hour's notice, or briefing the president on a day's packed schedule while we both jog across the tarmac to catch the car. It doesn't take me long to assess the layout of the library, and not much longer than that to go through a flowchart of options in my head about the best way to approach the search. A job well done is accomplished in the planning as much as in the execution, and even if I'm not technically being paid, even if this job doesn't affect anyone but Merlin and Nimue, it matters to me to do it well. There's a prickle of something at the back of my neck, hot and light all at once, and I look back at the doors just in time to see Sydney Blunt looking away from me.
Hey, lady listeners, we're back.
Hey.
So by now you know she's incredible and her words are amazing. And if you want to get more Sierra Simone right now, if you go to her website, sierrasimone.com, she has two books for free. And that's great. But if you want more audio from Sierra Simone, there's a new app called The Chirp. It's called Chirp. I don't know if you guys have heard of this, but if you go to Chirp, app you have to download. It's free. And then you get amazing deals on audiobooks through that app. And Sierra Simone has a book on Chirp right now for $1.99. It's called Sinner. And it's within the same world as the Priest book that I talked to you guys about earlier. And I'm going to read you the blurb for Sinner because you're going to want to go basically just download the Chirp app for free. And then you can buy her book for $1.99, Sinner, and you'll get access to like a bunch of other audiobook deals. You know, like it's a no brainer. You got to go do it. And we'll put the link in the episode notes as well. So here's the blurb for Sinner, which is an Entertainment Weekly top 10 romance of 2018. So that's badass. It's, I'm not a good man and I've never pretended to be. I don't believe in goodness or God or any happy ending that isn't paid for in advance. In fact, I've got my own personal holy trinity in the name of money, sex, and McAllen 18. Amen. So when the gorgeous, brilliant Zenny Iverson asks me to teach her about sex, I want to say yes, I really do. Unfortunately, there are several reasons to say no, reasons that even a very bad man like myself can't ignore. One, she's my best friend's little sister. Two, she's too young for me, like way too young. And three, she's a nun, or about to be, anyway. But I want her. I want her even with my best friend and God in the way. I want to teach her and touch her and love her. And I know that makes me something much worse than a very bad man. It makes me a sinner. And it's those very sins that are about to save me.
Ooh.
Yeah. So go download the Chirp app. Get Sinner by Sierra Simone. It's a limited time sale. So you got to just hop on it fast. And yeah, I mean, like I told you guys, Priest is the, I think that's the first book I've read by her, and besides American Squire and a couple others, but Priest is the one that like really turned me on to her, and it's amazing and it's so filthy. It's just like they fuck on the altar. Like I just have to tell you guys, it is filthy.
I think as a Catholic, you're and like blasphemous. I wonder if that's you're extra dirty because of that, because you're like those Catholic roots are just like, oh my God, this is so sacrilegious.
It's so it's just like unheard of. I mean, and it just happens. Like there's It's just, and just like the way they have sex is so, he's like very dominant and she like is all for being dominated. And, but he's like this soft, he's like this like holy man. He's a priest and he's a good man, but he has these impulses and so does she. And like it draws them to each other. It's so raw. I'm sweating thinking about it. Go get Priest, you guys, and then just go devour everything that she's ever written, because she's the new Camelot series is amazing. I just like, there's just so much you can get here, and you're about to embark on a fabulous journey. So we'll be back tomorrow with more. Did you guys have anything else that you wanted to say? Any books that are on sale? Or
I think we have stuff later this week, but not today.
Okay. We'll be back tomorrow with more American Squire by Sierra Simone. So wait by your headphones. There's more coming. Leah, tell them what to do.
Don't go anywhere. Fuck your day up. Make today your bitch. Don't be a dick.
Bye.
Read me romance. Read me romance. Read me romance. Read me romance.
You could take a look in a book, that's fine. Or you could sit back, relax, and unwind and read me romance. Read me romance.